Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 766 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another Valiant Sunday episode, and I have Jesse joining me today. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jace. I'm very excited.
Yeah, we're going to talk about a bit of Valiant news that came out of Emerald City Comic Con. Actually, had known about this for a while, but wasn't allowed to say anything. So I'm glad it's out there. Some Bloodshot news that we'll talk about. And then we're also going to talk about the upcoming Life and Death of Toyo Harada issue 1, which hits stands this coming Wednesday, March 20th. We're also going to give some thoughts about Incursion number 2 as that second issue hits stands as well, and maybe briefly touch on Life and Death of Toyo Harada number 2, which we got a chance to take a look at an unfinished preview. It was not colored, but we have some idea of what's going to happen next. So let's kick it off. You know what? And we're also going to talk about Livewire number 4, which just came out this last Wednesday, March 13th. So it's only been out for a few days, so we won't get too spoilery, but I do want to talk about it a little bit. I had some thoughts recently, and I wanted to run them by Jesse. So let's start off with Life and Death of Toyo Harada number 1. You want to give everybody sort of a recap of what this last piece of the puzzle is for Joshua Dysart with the story of Toyo. Obviously, the issue's not out yet, so we're not going to spoil, but we do want to kind of give you an idea and then kind of our thoughts on where the story might go and how it might wrap up what Josh has to say about Toyo Harada.
Oh, okay. So The Life and Death of Toyo Harada, issue number 1, you could almost say is Imperium issue number 17. Okay. Imperium is, of course, Imperium 1 would have been Harbinger issue number 26. So it's a Harbinger book in all but name. And it's the continuation of the story that we've waited for since Harbinger issue 1. You know, the chronology is very solid. You start with your Harbinger issue 1 through 25. It goes into Omegas 1 through 3, Imperium 1 through 16. And then that starts with what we're talking about right now, ultimately with Life and Death of Toyo Harada issues 1, which is absolutely incredible. It's written by Josh Dysart, which, of course, is he's the brains behind the Harbinger that we know today. It is very deep, has a lot of breadth and width to it. He understands the characters. He understands the story. He gets the nuances. He understands the complexities that make the Harbinger mythos what it is. Artwork, of course, by Miko Suiyan for flashback sequences, and the amazing Cafu, also known as Carlos Alberto Fernandez Ubano, I believe I got that right, hailing from Madrid, Spain. And this is, if you're a Valiant fan, and you've been a Valiant fan for a while, and you've been reading Valiant for a while, and you talk to Valiant fans on a regular basis, and you go to the cons, and you slap hands with Dinesh, and you get signatures by Josh, this is the book you've been waiting for. Oh my God. Basically, without spoiling, because we kind of should know a little bit about Harada, and we've talked about him quite a bit. Harada wants to stop world wars. He wants to stop a nuclear holocaust. He wants to stop world hunger. He wants to make a better world. And he believes, and he might be right, that he's the one to do it. The problem is, and this is something Josh Dysart captures so brilliantly, is that nothing is that simple. You know, we can turn on CNN and we can watch young freshman congressmen talking about amazing things and how we're going to make a better world, but it is not that simple. There's so many things that are involved in that, you know, and you see that in this story. You know, that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And it's not just, Toyo Harada by himself. He's got his own army with him. He's got people that are loyal to him. He's got people that are not loyal to him. He's got people with differing agendas. He's got people that are morally corrupt. He's got to juggle all these things. Plus, he has to deal with his own morality. There are things he has to do to get a positive end that he himself does not want to do or agree with morally, and it troubles him deeply. And that makes for a very complex story. It makes for a layered character, and it makes for possibly one of, if not the best series you are going to see this year.
Yeah, I agree with you. And what's so interesting about this is the fact that it's a continuation of the Harbinger story. But clearly, I mean, just look at the name. It's The Life and Death of Toya Harada. So it's also new reader friendly. You can, you don't have to have read. I mean, you should. Don't get me wrong. You should go back and have read all of Harbinger, all of Imperium, because it's an incredible story. But you don't necessarily need to have. You know, you can jump on this and get an idea of who Toya Harada is. And the other thing that's interesting, so when we look at Harbinger 1, it starts off and it's Pete. It's Pete's story. And we, you know, we follow Pete and his friend Joe as they, you know, are on the run. And then Pete loses Joe, starts to create the Renegades, kind of goes to war with Toyo. And in that way, the first 25 issues of Harbinger are much more of a kind of a Pete story than a Toyo story. But you start to see it transition toward the end. And then once we get to Imperium, it's all about Toyo in a way. And certainly this will be all about Toyo. And so it's interesting when you talk about Harbinger, that it's been debated who actually is the Harbinger. What does it, you know, the title mean? Who's the main character? But the fact of the matter is that when you look at these characters, and maybe it's just because that's where Joshua Dysart's interest lay, more toward this character who engenders the immediate debate. Good guy, bad guy, hero, villain, and that's Toya Harada. I think he's one of the most incredibly complex and interesting characters that's been created in comics in the last, you know, 10 years, 15 years. And I know he was created back in the 90s, but he didn't have the level of complexity that Josh brought to the character. And what's interesting here is in the life of death of Toya Harada, I think one of the things that Josh is doing is he's really... he's given us more of some look backs at what happened to Toyo after his powers were awakened, after the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and helping us to understand and empathize with who Toyo Harada is, why he makes the decisions that he makes. And again, already there are those Harbinger fans, those Valiant fans, who believe that because of the goals that Harada has, that he is a hero. I don't happen to fall on that side. I think he's a villain, but I still understand his motivations. I understand what he's trying to do. I just think that I don't think you can get to where he wants to go by doing it the way that he wants to do it. But the more I understand him, I possibly could change my mind. I mean, again, I see both sides. And what Josh is introducing here in Life and Death of Toya Harada is more context into who Toyo is, as well as just a really great story. So many layers with, like Jesse was saying, people he can trust, people he can't trust, what's going to happen. Because this is going to be Joshua Dysart's last statement, at least as far as we know, for now. I hope, you know, it would be great if he, 10 years down the line or 5 years down the line, he decided to come back to the character. But as far as he's concerned, this is his last statement on the character that he really put his stamp on and again, didn't create him because he was created in the 90s, but really changed him and turned him into one of the most interesting characters in comics. It's like Magneto, but, you know, with the ambiguousness of is he good, is he bad, but even more so because, again, the motivations are more relatable, more in the now. They're not quite so incredible as Magneto's are in terms of living in a world that's super fantastical. You know, the world of Valiant is much more the world outside your window, so to speak. So I'm really looking forward to it. And again, I it's one of those things too, where as powerful as Toya Harada is, there are things going on that appear like they may throw a monkey wrench in his plans. And you just wonder if that's going to ultimately be his downfall. So, yeah, I really enjoy the first issue. I'm really excited to see it come out this Wednesday and see everybody's reaction to it. And then I'm curious, Jesse, you got to check out issue two. What were your thoughts there?
Well, as good as issue one was, and I already knew coming into issue one was going to be great. Issue two is just compelling. And like I said, you said earlier, we haven't actually read, the final finished polished version. We get to see, an uncolored format, which is fine. That's Pulp Fiction. That's classic Ashcan style. I can deal with that. I love it. But I will say that, you can feel it. Like every page I flip, I've got a borderline anxiety attack. I'm waiting for the next, a layer to be added, the next stakes to be upped, the next complexity to the complex. This story is unfolding, and right in front of me, just like it does in any comic book. But you're invested in it. You care. You see, and you can. Almost it's like watching a really, really good movie unfold on paper in front of you. And I gotta say, man, with all this, with this entire series, Cafu's artwork is just phenomenal. I think he first started drawing for Valiant back with like Shadow Man issue 12 back in 2013, and he was good. He didn't really blow me away at the time. But since then, he has jumped up with over 40 covers. He's done, I think, close to 50 or 60 different interior books. He's transitioned into using Copic markers and over warm pencils. It's just so clean, so smooth. I remember, reading and seeing his work in Unity early on. And then I think it was around Exo Manowar's 25th anniversary special, number one, that I said, wow, holy crap, look at this guy's work. The characters, you can see their emotion, you can see their humanity, you can see the background of these worlds that just would look incredible in an animated feature or on film. I saw his work on Rye and during the first 4001 series with Cy Albato and Rye in himself, and it was just, I couldn't believe how good it was and how far he's evolved at this point. And so, as I understand it, this is going to be his last work, along with Josh Dysart. It's going to be Cafu's last work for the foreseeable future with Valiant. I don't think he's going to be doing anything else traditionally either. I think he's going to focus mostly on digital work from now on, which is a real shame because his actual traditional work is phenomenal. I love it so much. I own four of his covers hanging in my office on the wall. I understand that, Marvel's always out there and DC's out there. He needs to do some Batman work or he needs to do some Superman. But my God, I can tell you this, Valiant Entertainment, Cafu is 120% pure gold as an artist. He really is. And you guys got to, Valiant needs to pay this guy whatever it costs to keep him in the fold doing what he does best, which is building and expanding the Valiant universe. I can't say it enough. The artists like Cafu, Luis LaRosa, Miko Suiyan, Clayton Henry, they really have made some of the most magical experiences that we have seen in the VU. I really, really want editorial and management to know that as fans, God damn, these guys are Valiant. They really are.
Yeah, I have a Cafu Superman commission, and it's pretty sweet. I echo your thoughts on the artwork. It's spectacular, especially because, as I mentioned, the preview copy that we got to check out was in black and white. So you really get to see the line work and the facial expressions come across even more in the detail in the arts. Yeah, and Miko Suyan's art on the flashback that we get in the beginning too is also really spectacular. So yeah, issue two, it really, as fast paced as issue one is, I think issue two picks up the pace even more. And it kind of makes sense. This is only a 6-issue series, and as I mentioned earlier, it's Josh is wrapping up his story, so it's going to have to move along at a pretty big clip. And I think there's going to be, when all is said and done, a lot for us Valiant fans to kind of debate, go back and kind of dissect the story and say, okay, here's what happened, here's what Josh told us happened. And look at all these different points in the story where it could have gone totally differently. Like what, you know, kind of like a what if. Like what if Harada had known about the people that were kind of sneaking around behind his back? Or what if, you know, this battle had gone this way? Or he, you know, different things like that. So those kind of stories that engender the conversation like that, I think are really great. And this is really going to have, I expect to it to have long lasting effects on the Valiant universe going forward for a long time. So I'm like really curious. And, you know, the whole thing's been done for a long time. They were just waiting for the right time to release it. So that's the other thing. It's like, so thanks for sending me issue two early. Like issue one hasn't even dropped yet and I have issue two, but could you go ahead and send me, you know, 3, 4, 5, and 6 also? So I can just read the whole thing. Cause I really want to check it out. So, all right. Let's move on and talk about, Livewire. Any last thoughts on, life and death of Toyo Harada, Jesse?
No, it's real simple. Read it. Yeah, it's worth your time.
Yes, 100%. Like if you were a Valiant fan at all, this is the title to be reading. And not even a Valiant fan, just a comic fan. I mean, I think it was probably when Harbinger got up to about issue 18, maybe even 15, where when people would ask me, hey, I want to start reading comics. And again, this was like 2014 or so, 2013, 2014. So, you know, Iron Man had come out, the MCU was blowing up, comics were becoming the center of pop culture, and people would want to invest in something. They'd want to read some comics, check it out. What's all this excitement about? And Harbinger was always one of the titles that I gave them. Like, okay, well, the first thing you need to read is this, because that's how incredible I think it is. So it is bittersweet that we're getting the end of Josh's time on this title, but I'm very curious to see how he ends it, what this final story, Life and Death of Toyo Harada, is going to contain. And I'm also very curious about the future. So there was announced at the Emerald City Comic Con Diamond Distributor Retail Breakfast, in the presentation that Valiant did, that Harbinger is going to return later this year. So I'm very curious. I mean, we don't know. I mean, is Toyo Harada going to survive Life and Death of Toyo Harada? I mean, in the title, you would think maybe not. You know, it's going to have his death in it. But, and we know in the Valiant universe, dead is dead. So that would be really interesting. And I don't know. I mean, I would never say that the story Josh wants to tell and the decisions he makes, if he were to choose to kill Harada, it would be a mistake. But at the same time, he's such an interesting character and by far the best villain in the Valiant universe. So would you really want to take future story potential away from anybody coming on the Harbinger property later on to not have this incredible villain, this incredible threat? So again, we'll have to wait and see. But I am very curious to, first of all, to see who the creative team is for this new Harbinger title and what stories they decide to tell. Because we did have the Renegades title that was telling sort of the story of Harbinger after Imperium ended and before Life and Death of Toyo Harada. And was it Rafer Roberts that was writing that, Jesse?
It was Rafer. I said from day one, I don't know if this is going to work. Rafer is a ironic and kind of sarcastic and kind of more fun writer. And Harbinger was not the right series for him.
Yeah, I mean, I remember reading it and I thought it was okay, but it didn't have that spark or that magic that Harbinger had. And again, it's, you know, like you said, it's just different writing styles. So what, for, you know, the question we have to ask ourselves, okay, what does Valiant want to do with the property once Life and Death of Toyo Harada is over? I mean, obviously you've got it. It's such a great property. There's such great characters. You need to keep creating stories with them, especially because we possibly have a Harbinger movie coming later on. So you want to, you know, keep comics out there. You want to keep comics on the stands that have these characters, in them and continue to tell their stories. But so again, a couple questions. What is the story that they want to tell? What is the story that fits into the Valiant universe? And obviously it's going to, the ramifications of this Life and Death of Toyo Harada series are going to echo through that. And the other big question is, who do you get to write it? As important as the artist will be, I think the writer is even more important because, as Jesse just mentioned, you know, Rafer Roberts, really talented guy. He's written some things that I really love. I thought his stuff on Archer and Armstrong was good. But again, it did for Harbinger. I agree with Jesse. He wasn't the right person because he didn't bring the same sort of sensibility that I think Harbinger needs. So it's going to be paramount to have a really, really great writer who understands these characters. And I'm in the back of my mind right now, I'm trying to think of who I would pick to write it. Nobody's immediately springing to mind. You have any, anybody on your wish list to take on Harbinger as a writer?
No, I can't. I can tell you this. I've had three possibilities of how this thing ends. Either, like you said, Toyo dies, or the life and death of Toyo Harada really relates to the life and death of the character as we've known it, because no one can write him to the same level and the same complexity following that. And I guess a distant third would be that would be the death of Toyo's dream. And then a new direction for him as a person, as in he dies because his dream is dead and he still lives on as a person. But the hopes and dreams that he had in his heart, you know, for the humanity just are gone and he has to take a different route. That's also a possibility. Maybe Alan Moore could write him.
Alan Moore. That would be interesting. I don't even, he would probably say, I don't even know who the bloody hell Harbinger is. That would be good. You start thinking about, well, let's just put a great writer on it. But again, not necessarily know if they would be a good fit because, you know, like Scott Snyder or Tom King, you know, these guys who can write really, especially Tom King, you know, he really gets in there with some angst. But I don't know. Maybe the Harbinger Kids need a break. Maybe it needs to be a little bit of a brighter title. So I don't know. I guess we'll see. But I will say that I agree with you or with one of your theories anyway about life and death of Toyo Harada. My initial thought when I saw the title was, yeah, it's going to be, as you said, kind of the death of his dream. And I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't necessarily die, but is kind of taken off the board, so to speak, if he kind of goes into hiding. I almost wonder, and it's been so long since I've read Bleeding Monk. Is it possible that Harada could be the Bleeding Monk?
It's possible entirely.
So what if
time travel exists?
Yeah. If he just goes off and like sits somewhere for like a really long time and then, you know, eventually becomes a Bleeding Monk. I don't know. Just a thought I had. All right. Let's talk about Livewire number 4. I'm not going to go into any of the story points necessarily because, again, it just came out this last Wednesday. But we do, you know, kind of continuing out from issue 3 where Amanda's really – we're seeing that she's starting to realize kind of the extent of the damage that she caused when she basically shut off all the power to Earth, all the electronic devices. And in this issue, it becomes like really obvious. Like she literally like says the words, I didn't realize what I did. You know, I was backed into a corner. I made a terrible choice. And she talks about needing to spend the rest of her life making up for what she did. And so I totally agree that it's what was necessary. It's what is necessary to kind of redeem this character. And when I talked to Vita Ayala at New York Comic Con last October, they were saying exactly that. But I do sort of wonder. I mean, it wasn't Vita's choice at all to do this, to have Amanda have Livewire have taken this action. It was Eric Heiser, and obviously there was a lot of other people involved. I mean, he wasn't somebody who'd been at Valiant so long and had all this power to just say, I'm going to do this with this character. You know, if Valiant Editorial didn't want him to do it, he wouldn't have done it. But I do wonder, I was thinking about it this morning, was it a mistake to have her do this? Because now, and it really kind of hit me when I read issue 4 when Amanda said that. Like, yeah, it's going to always follow her around. It's always going to be part of her story. And she's going to have to spend the rest of her life making up for it or trying to make up for it. So you kind of wonder, okay, is the character tainted now? And there's more to it. Again, I don't want to spoil issue four because there's another big kind of story point and part of the story that another realization that Amanda makes in the story, which totally makes sense and helps kind of explain why she felt she needed to do what she did. You know what I'm talking about, Jesse?
I do.
Yeah. And so yeah. I hope that the character is not tainted, because here's the thing. She's such an interesting character and such an important part of the Valiant universe. And I want talented creators like Vida to be able to tell the stories they want to tell without always having the kind of the baggage of this choice that she made. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And here's the reality, though. One of the things that has made the Valiant universe very, very strong, and it hasn't always been this way in Valiant, they fluctuate sometimes, like all publishers do, is grounding the story in reality. I don't believe that I have ever gone out and killed somebody. I don't believe I've ever murdered anybody. But if I had, I can tell you that that would follow me around. It would affect who I am as a person. I can tell you that there are stories where people have been indirectly responsible for death, for destruction. And it becomes a defining moment in their existence where they will, almost seek to atone for that, for their sins until their dying day, or even to the point where it sets them up for the death that they receive. As the final payment for their crimes. I can tell you, you look at something like an airplane flying into a tower on 9/11. Okay, that was one of the biggest things that happened in American history. Now, if that was a comic book, it'd be a Tuesday, you know. But the reality is these small little nuanced things that occur have massive ripple effects. And so... when you're looking at a nanite disease breakout in New York City, or when you're looking at the armor hunters destroying Mexico City, or when you're looking at Livewire taking down the electric grid, you're talking about things that, in comic world might go away in 5 seconds. But if you're going to ground yourself in reality, they're going to change the character forever, because there's no going back. There's no reset button. There's no once you end life, indirectly or otherwise, once you destroy economies and relationships, once you place others against their will on a path that they had never intended, you carry that with you, or you are a villain.
Yeah, that's a good point. I keep in my mind, and it's so funny. I just talked about how Valiant is much more the world outside your window, but I always kind of in my mind compare Livewire to Jean Grey. Especially with this, recent choice that Livewire made to that resulted in, thousands of people dying. And you compare that to Jean Grey when she was, Dark Phoenix, and she, killed a bunch of people. Then we found out it wasn't really her, and whatever, comics, fantasy. But yeah, you're right. I mean, Marvel is a much more, and I said it myself a little while ago, Marvel's a much more fantastical world, where, something happens and maybe there's consequences for a little while, but then they eventually go away. And that, those actions of Jean Grey as Dark Phoenix don't really follow her around. I mean, granted, it's been 40 years or 30 years or whatever. It's interesting. I still can't help in my mind but think of Livewire as sort of the Jean Grey of the Valiant universe. I think Livewire's that important, maybe even more important to the Valiant universe than Jean Grey is to the Marvel universe. But that's the comparison that I've been making in my mind. And maybe you're right. Maybe that's not a good comparison to make, because this is going to follow her around, as you said. And if it were something to have happened in our world, in real life, then yeah, that totally would follow her around for the rest of her life, and rightfully so. So I don't know in that way if it was a good story choice, if the character is Tatum. I mean, I guess if this is the story Valiant wanted to tell, how do you atone for something that you can never really make up for, and to that point, what Amanda says in this issue, I'm going to spend the rest of my life honoring their memory by continuing to fight for justice. Which I suppose if you were one of the people that died, or you know somebody that died during the event. It may sound kind of hollow unless you are specifically saved in some way by Amanda later on down the line. You know, then it's sort of a life for a life in that aspect. But
yeah, there's things that you never can atone for. But then again, maybe I don't know. If you go back and you read Book of Death, The Fall of Ninjak, which happens, I believe, 150 to 200 years from today. You know, there's an interaction between a very, very old and wounded Ninjak talking to Livewire, who we already know from reading, has been his friend, his lover, his confidant. And he indicates in that, you know, that wasn't the real Livewire, that it's a clone, it's been reprogrammed with the memories of, you know, of someone who died long ago, who was a great person, who was an amazing, one of the finest heroes that the world had ever known. And, you know, and that's how he would remember her. But, you know, that woman had died long ago. So will Valiant remember this? Well, if publishing history is anything, they may or may not, because, you know, publishers do not always remember the very things that they write. They often don't honor the very mythos that they create. But if I, as the fan, remember this, then that would indicate that Livewire does recover. Livewire does become the hero she was meant to be. She does become the Wonder Woman of the Valiant Universe, who stands tall and leads Psyots and the disenfranchised into the future, and does her very best to become the hero and atone for the sins of the past, which is all that anyone could ever do. So I've got my fingers crossed.
Yeah, and that should be what the next arc of Livewire is about, right? I mean, we see at the end of issue 4, she talks about, okay, it's time to get to work, basically. Like, she realizes, I think, finally the magnitude of what she's done. Because in a way, right after it happened, and even maybe in the first issue of the Livewire series, she felt bad about what happened, but she was kind of defiant, like, well, what choice did I have? They didn't give me a choice. They backed me into a corner. You know, it's their fault. It's the government's fault for, you know, hunting down Psyot children, and they didn't leave me a choice. And so in a way, she was still defiant, even though she felt bad for the damage that she caused. Now it seems like it's come more full circle. She understands that it was a bad choice. She lost control. And she should have found another way, which is what heroes do. So very curious to see where Vita takes the story next. And the cover for, I guess it's issue 5, it's a Kenneth Rocafort, if I'm not mistaken. It looks really, really cool. So I'm very, very curious to see what happens next, because the only hint we have, it just says back to school. So the other thing that's been happening with Livewire from the first time we saw her in the pages of Harbinger, the writers and creators over at Valiant are really starting to get creative with the way she can use her powers. She's really become one of the most powerful people in the Valiant universe. Whereas in those first few appearances in Harbinger, she's powerful, you know, but nowhere near the way she has power now, I think. Would you agree with that, Jesse?
Yeah, I can speak to that. Yeah. So if you were to follow the power history of Amanda, she was well-trained by Harada. She had good control over machines. Then later on in Unity, she wears the Shannara Exo-Manowar suit. She's one of the only other humans on Earth. I think she is the only other human on Earth to ever wear it. And that opened up her powers and multiplied them like by 50 times. And that makes sense, you know, because it educated her about things that she would have spent a lifetime mastering. And so we needed that move. And beyond that, her technological abilities led her to invent suits that would allow her to fly, suits that would give her laser blasters, suits that would allow. So she was able to do a lot of things. You know, through almost like Iron Man style technological advancements, could make her a formidable opponent in the battle space. Basically, I mean, her suits were kind of, if you want to say it, a less durable version of Iron Man's suit without a helmet. I mean, that's basically what it was, because it's the same kind of setup. And that has worked. That's how she's been able to manifest. Her powers aren't really flying. Her powers aren't really laser blast. Her power, that's all technology. And you can do that. The problem is, as always is the case, writers and artists forget. And now they have her flying without her suit. Or now they have her shooting lasers or whatever without it. And now you're scratching your head and you're like, wait, what? Yeah. And that's because you and I have studied this and followed this forever. You know, where somebody else, all they have to do is make one artistic or creative misstep, and now you have a overpowered live wire that's able to do things on a level that she was never intended to do. She should have her powers, ability to talk to machines. She should be a very strong and able-bodied woman. She should be able to create advanced technology. Should she be able to fly without a suit and control all the machines on Earth at the same exact time? I mean, did her brain become a computer? I don't think so. I think she still has a human brain, and that would greatly limit the amount of information she can process and the amount of things she can handle at once. She is becoming a Mary Sue, and we got to watch out for that because the internet is ready to devour Mary Sues in about 2 seconds. Got to give them a earthly grounding and keep them in the realm of reality. Otherwise, then, you know, people just start, you know, tearing it up as opposed to praising it.
Yeah, we did see at issue 4 that apparently she sort of unlocked her next level of power. And through no particular, it wasn't anything that in particular that happened. It just all of a sudden she had like some epiphany, light bulb went on, and she's starting to be able to fly and do other things without, as Jesse said, that technology to help her. So yeah, it's a slippery slope for sure. So we'll have to watch that. And I do want to move on to Incursion, but one more thing that we have to mention about Livewire before we move on is that the art team of Raoul Allen and Patricia Martin, you know, from the moment that I first saw Secret Weapons that they did with Eric Heiser, like, they have been the perfect art team in my mind to illustrate Livewire and the other characters from Secret Weapons. And I feel like, kind of like I do with the Clayton Henry, like, I don't want anyone to draw Armchair and Armstrong except for Clayton Henry, kind of like I don't want anybody but Fred Van Lente to write those characters. I don't want anybody doing a Livewire title except for Raoul Allen and Patricia Martin, because the tone, the mood, the line work, the colors, like, everything is so perfect to tell the story of these characters when Raoul Allen and Patricia Martin handled the artwork. So I hope they, much like you were saying with Cafu, I hope that Valiant realizes that and they keep these two on this title for a long, like as long as there's a Livewire title or a Secret Weapons title, then it needs to be these two doing the handling the art duties. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I get it. You know, I was first introduced to Allen and Martin. I know that Allen had done a couple covers or various things here and there, but it was in Wrath of the Eternal Warrior. And I started reading it, and at first I was like, I don't know about this. Man, that was one of the best series that, you know, Valiant ever produced. I mean, it was phenomenal. And a lot of that really had to do with Allen's ability to tell a story on paper. The sequence, the angles, it's incredible. And so when I heard that he was going to be doing, Secret Weapons, I already knew what we were getting. And of course he had previously worked with Martin quite a bit. So I knew that the color palette was going to be consistent. I knew it was going to be, it wasn't just going to be coloring for the sake of colors. It was going to be coloring to tell the story, to tell the mood. And we've had that ever since, you know. And so from Secret Weapons into the Harbinger Wars 2 Prelude and now into the Livewire series, I completely agree with you. There comes a point where when you are telling a story with your writing that the artwork behind it, there's an expectation. It almost becomes a character in itself. You know, you don't want your writing to portray somebody out of character, and you don't want your art to portray them out of character either. So it really boils down to keeping Martin and Allen on this title for quite some time, mainly because they get it. they get it, and they give us Livewire the way she's meant to be provided.
Yeah, I totally agree. All right, let's talk about Incursion issue 2. Obviously, no spoilers, because again, it hasn't come out yet. It's coming out this coming Wednesday, March 20th. I really felt like the pacing in the first issue was done well. We got enough action to make it exciting, but we also got enough story to kind of give us an idea of who Imperatrix Virago is. We got some characterization with Gilad and Tama, and we're starting to see the kind of the father-daughter relationship there blossom, and the feeling that Gilad has of responsibility, maybe in a different way than he's felt responsible for previous Geomancers. Because Tama is so young, there's more of a, as I said, a father-daughter relationship. So I like that aspect. We did hear Alex Pacnadel, when he was on the show, say that if you are going to kind of pin down this story and say, you know, is it a what kind of story is it? Is it a Geomancer story? Is it a villainous story? Is it a Eternal Warrior story? He said, no, this is a Gilad story, right? There's no Eternal Warrior title right now, but this would be a story that would fit in an Eternal Warrior title. Gilad is the main character. This is his story. So I really liked the pacing in the first issue. I thought it was one of the things that Alex and his co-writer Andy Diggle did really, really well. In fact, I think it's always one of Andy's strengths as a writer is pacing. So that being said, the second issue, the pace picks up. It starts off with a little bit of explanation. We see an appearance by Dr. Mirage with Gilad, and kind of getting up to speed on what's going on and asking for advice about Dr. Mirage about what, like, her take on Tama's infection, basically. And then from there, it's like pedal to the metal, like it's almost paced too quickly. And I only say that because it would have been cool to see the things that Gilad has to do. It would have been cool to see them fleshed out a little bit more. But again, I know this is a limited series and you have things that you need to get to, and you don't want it to drag and feel like, oh, they're just padding it. This didn't need to be like a 10-issue miniseries. But and Jesse will know what I'm talking about because he's read it already. But there's kind of this gauntlet, so to speak, that Gilad has to go through. And each part of the gauntlet could have been an issue. So I have mixed feelings about it. Because, again, the art from Doug Braithwaite is incredible, and being able to see him do more action as Gilad goes through this gauntlet would have been spectacular. But at the same time, if you're just doing it for the sake of doing it and it doesn't really service the story, because I do realize that it's like, okay, if you would have had each of the particular parts of the things that Gilad had to go through be its own issue, other than just watching him like hack stuff up and fight, like what, and having cool Doug Braithwaite art, then what really, you know, how does it service the story? So I totally get it. But again, it does make it feel like the pace is like breakneck speed, which again is okay, because like the way the issue ends, you feel like in the next issue, we're going to get another big chunk of story, because it really moved forward from where we start on page one of issue two to where it ends. We did get a big chunk of story, and that's really good, because then I always feel like, okay, you got good value for your money. You know, comics aren't cheap these days. And the other thing about it is this is Valiant's first big event series that we've had since Harbinger Wars 2. And that left such a bad taste in my mouth, and really a lot of Valiant fans. You know, we've talked about it ad nauseum on the show about how it just didn't work. And a lot of it had to do with changing creative teams and midstream and all that. So the first part of Harbinger Wars 2, it was supposed to initially be 6 issues, got reduced to 4. They took what would have been issue 1 of Harbinger Wars 2 and turned it into the prelude. And that was great. That was a spectacular issue. It was the last work that Eric Heiser did at Valiant. But then with the very next part of the story, Harbinger Wars 2, issue 1, you really saw that decline in quality, immediately I had problems with it. So not that I was necessarily worried, but at least we saw a high quality issue for incursion number one, high quality issue number two. So I'm not worried about the story falling off a cliff. And I'm hoping that this event will kind of wash the bad taste out of my mouth that Harbinger Wars 2 was. And I saw a lot of people, especially on the Valiant fans forums, kind of say they're giving up on Valiant. And I've been encouraging everybody, like, just give them one more shot. Like, read Incursion, and because it does feel much more like classic quality Valiant. Like, don't get me wrong, the magic times of 2012, 2013, 2014, we haven't quite gotten back to that level. But I think this is really, really good storytelling. It's an interesting story. And we're getting to see more of the dead side than we've ever seen before in terms of like specific locations and the way things work over there. And I think that's interesting because I think it's sort of an untapped potential. And Alex said that when he was on the show as well, that we'd see more of it. So I thought the second issue was great. And I can't wait for the next issue. What did you think of issue two, Jesse?
I think it looks visually amazing. I really like Doug's work. Colors are vibrant. Colors are sharp. It is very fast paced. It feels condensed. I'm not going to say it's bad. It's not bad. But one of the problems is I'm reading this issue at the same time I'm reading The Life and Death of Toyo Harada, which is a 10. And so it's kind of like watching Marvel's Infinity War and then like going and watching the Justice League the following week or something. It's just they can't compare. Maybe it would be a different experience if, you know, if I read Incursion 6 months ago, or maybe it'd be a different one if I read it a year from now. It's not bad. Don't get me wrong. It's not as tight. It's not as compelling as I would like it. And it could be, or maybe my expectations are just too high. I'm not dogging on it. I'm going to read it. I'm going to enjoy it. But I don't know if 5 years from now, if I'm going to remember it.
Yeah. I think the thing that will determine if it has any sort of legacy, any consequence is how much it does change Gilad. Like how much it adds or takes away or changes his characterization. Because again, when we had Alex on the show, he talked about the fact that that's one of the things that he wanted to do is really explore the feelings that Gilad has about being a father and you know, because he's reproducing. He has many, many children around the world. He's lived so long. But we never really see him in those terms. He doesn't really think about it or talk about it. And so if coming out of this, that's more of a kind of a central part of the character, then I think we will look back on this and remember it for having that impact, if nothing else. But I do agree with you. It doesn't compare to Life and Death of Toyo Harada. I don't really compare them in my mind because, yeah, they are so vastly different. I think Life and Death is going to be a seminal series. It's one of those, great comic book stories that I look at and say, okay, this is the reason sequential art and sequential storytelling exist. It's a perfect example. It's a great series that you would give a non-comic reader to get them hooked. Incursion is just like a fun popcorn kind of, action movie where you read it, you enjoy it, and then, yeah, you may or may not remember it, next week or next month or whatever. So incredible Doug Braithwaite art, though, like you mentioned. The guy's his art is really incredible. I love how I love the angles he chooses to illustrate action, to do close-ups on faces and such. It's a very cinematic. He makes very cinematic choices. Just mentioning it feeling like a big action summer blockbuster kind of feel to it, and yeah, I could totally see that in the choices that he makes. I think that's probably part of the reason I get that feeling when I look at it, and seeing him be able to draw like monsters and demons and such, because it's the dead side, is just icing on the cake. So yeah, incredible job by Doug Braithwaite. He's on the top of my list of artists who I need to get. I need to either get a commission or original art. I don't have anything from Doug. I've never seen him do a show, so I don't know.
He's hard to get. He's hard to get. Myself, Dan Moeller, Stephen Coates, a couple of the big time art collectors in the Valiant game. Man, we've tried. We've reached out, sent emails, looked on Facebook, tried Twitter. It's difficult to get Doug. I don't know. Maybe we're just pushing the wrong buttons.
Well, it's good to have goals, Jesse.
Indeed.
So, can definitely put that on the list. Doug Braithwaite art. All right. Anything else we want to say about Incursion?
No. I mean, you definitely should take a look at Incursion. Read it. It's again not bad. It looks good, and it actually is written well. It's a 4-issue series, so I mean it's going to be paced very quick. But then again, maybe you like that, so give it a shot.
All right. So, what was your reaction? Well, first of all, did you see the little tease that Mel put out a few weeks ago about this big name artist coming to Valiant on an ongoing?
Oh yeah. It's all over social media, and of course everybody was speculating about it. And you know,
did you know who it was?
Let's see here. No.
Okay. Yeah, I'm a big fan of. It's Brett Booth is who it is, and I'm a huge fan of Brett. I have more original pages of his art than anyone else. Looking at it right now, I have a couple pages of, quite a few pages of Flash actually. Like, six or so, and then like three or four pages of his new 52 Teen Titans run. I also have a full Nightwing that he did, like a big commission on an 11.5 by 17, like basically a comic page, but he turned it over and did Nightwing on the back. And so I have that. So yeah, I'm a big fan of Brett. I think that when it comes to like laying the panels out on the page, he's a master at that, especially in his recent Flash run. I guess it's been a few years now, but he had so many interesting ways of laying out panels to help convey movement and action and move the story along. Like, just incredible. Like, when you want to talk about keeping it visually interesting and not just laying it out on a grid, it's kind of the old school way. Brett is a master at that. So when I saw the art, like, immediately I knew who it was, and then knowing what I knew about what was coming down the line, I was like, yeah, he's probably going to be the one that's going to be on Bloodshot with Tim Seeley. And then sure enough, at Emerald City Comic Con, again at the Diamond Retailer Breakfast, it was announced by Valiant that the Rising Spirit is going to come to an end with after issue 8, the Bloodshot Rising Spirit, and we're going to get a new Bloodshot title. Tim Seeley, who, you know, you probably could have guessed he was going to write the next Bloodshot title based on the fact that we know that the Valiant Free Comic Book Day issue is going to have a Bloodshot story written by Tim Seeley in it. So the writing was on the wall there. And Brett Booth's going to be handling the art duties. So what was your reaction when you heard the news?
My reaction was, ha, I was right. Bloodshot Rising Spirit was filler. It's something to kill the time without progressing the story while they got their footing down, and as we moved closer to 2020's release of the Bloodshot movie. Because I was like, well, you know, what do you do? Because they want to have Bloodshot in circulation. Well, I guess what you do is you have a whole bunch of glitchy program back flashbacks that really are not occurring necessarily in reality. And you play with the character a little bit, but you don't change the character so that you can kill 6 months to a year and then start telling the stories you want. And that's, I think, what we're going to see here. So without any real knowledge about how they're going to play out Bloodshot with this new series, I believe that this new series is really the first Bloodshot series, the first one that the modern new Valiant under DMG is going to execute as we lead into this into the film universe moving forward. I believe that Rising Spirit was something to fill the time. It was a more of a fun kind of a Bloodshot-y experience.
Yeah, and again, I feel bad because it was another one of those situations where they had a creative team in place with Lonnie Nadler and Zach Thompson, and then they just were too busy. They couldn't commit to it as much as they probably needed to. So again, you know, they brought on Kevin Grievous, and it's been okay. But I would say, you know, it's not really what you want when you somebody review, oh, what did you think of this comic? Well, it was okay. You know, I kind of take it or leave it. And again, I just kind of feel bad because it could have been something interesting. And I think if, you know, knowing what I know of Lonnie and Zach, I enjoy their work. I think it would have been a more high quality product. I think they probably had a pretty good idea of what they wanted to do rather than we're probably getting sort of a watered down secondhand version from Kevin Grievous, who is talented as well. But, you know, his primary area of creative endeavor isn't comics. You know, he's a filmmaker, so it doesn't always translate necessarily. So I agree with you. I think this Bloodshot we get from Seeley and Booth is really the first DMG Bloodshot and the first Bloodshot we're going to get that builds on what Jeff Lemire did. So the only hints that we've had, and you can go and seek out the interviews. Seeley's been given interviews at Emerald City Comic Con this weekend about his plans for the character. I think Sci-Fi Wire had one of them. And I haven't sought them all out myself and watched them all yet, but I did see where Seeley said that basically what he's looking at doing is taking a third person approach to the story, as opposed to a lot of what Lemire did was all first person, you know, told from the perspective of Bloodshot. And that's part of the reason we got so much introspection and we got so much analysis of the character and who he was and who he is. More so than we ever had done before. And so, you know, Jesse and I, when we talked about the final issue of Bloodshot Salvation, we were speculating. So what happens now? Like who comes on and picks up this story? So I think it's a smart choice for Seeley to do, to not go back to that first person narrative and to look at it from a third person, because then you don't necessarily have to dive into those feelings and try to follow in the footsteps of what Jeff Lemire did, because I think that would be really hard. But it's not to say that you couldn't explore that at some point, or if Jeff Lemire wanted to come back on the character, he couldn't explore that at some point. But shifting the perspective, you can just make it you know, fun and action-oriented and tell some really cool Bloodshot stories with this dynamic action-oriented art of Brett Booth's. And it will suit the kind of the movie going audience who don't know Bloodshot that well. You know, they're not going to, if they were to pick up, you know, like say someone goes and watches the Bloodshot movie and then they immediately come out and pick up like Bloodshot Salvation Volume 2 and read that, they're going to be lost. They're going to be like, wait, why is he talking about his feelings and this and that? It won't, you know, I don't think it'll match up well. But if you have something on the stands that from Seeley and Booth that's kind of action oriented and it has more of the same sort of fast pace and tone of the movie, then I think you've got something there. You know, we've seen that these movies, although they're making billions of dollars, literally billions of dollars, they're not really moving the needle on comic sales. So it may not matter, but at least you give yourself the opportunity, at least give yourself the chance, you know, for some fans, some moviegoers to come and pick up a Bloodshot title that has the same sort of sensibility, I guess is the best word way to put it. So any thoughts on that, Jesse, the kind of the changing perspective from first person to third in a Seeley?
No, I think that'll work. It'll be a different type of storytelling. I'm not going to say it's safer. It kind of is in a way, and it kind of isn't in a way. I would be shocked. I'm going to make a prediction. Write it down. I would be shocked if the Bloodshot movie trailer doesn't come out around the same time as the release of this this comic. Not because, you know, they're going to move the trailer for that, but let's be honest here. If you're looking at a February 2020 release, then, you know, September certainly wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility for some early teasers. 6 months, you know, that's fine. You can do that. And so I could see where they would be putting out issue number one right around that time. So you have the build up, a couple weeks or a couple months of build up on the comic, then bam, all the marketing and media that comes from the trailer and all the discussion that, and you know, Jimbo in his trailer park goes, "Oh my God, well, that looks pretty interesting. Better go on down to yonder comic shop and pick up one of them dare books." You know, I can easily see that happening, and I bet you they go hand in hand.
Yeah, it would be, I mean, that's probably exactly why they're releasing the next volume of Bloodshot when they are, because you're right, it's probably going to drop at the same time as the trailer. And then I would expect that volume one of Trade would be out as a, about the same time as the movie as well. That way, if anybody does go and see the movie, hey, you can go pick up this, you know, as many non-comic readers think of it, this graphic novel, even though it's technically not a graphic novel, it's a trade paperback, but that's how they think of it. And they say, oh, I can go pick up this, you know, this big chunk of Bloodshot story, which should be the first arc. So I like Tim Seeley. I think he's a good writer of sort of traditional superhero comics. I haven't read a lot of his other, like Hack and Slash, or I can't remember the other Image title that he wrote that was sort of about people that were not, that were dead but weren't dead.
Revival,
that's it. Yeah. I didn't read either of those, but I've read a lot of his DC work and his Aftershock work, and I've enjoyed it. So yeah, Bloodshot's my favorite character, and I'm looking forward to having something that feels a little more traditional Bloodshotty, as Jesse was saying earlier. Because, yeah, Rising Spirit has just been kind of meh for me so far. All right. I think that's going to do it for this episode. Anything else you want to add, Jesse?
No, I'm just I'm looking forward to getting an opportunity to read issue 3 of The Life and Death of Toyo Harada. And I'm also anxiously awaiting some of the original cover art to show up in my mailbox so I can take it down to Hobby Lobby, get it framed, and put it in my office.
Yeah, Jesse sent me a text the other day that had some Toyo Harada covers, and I was like, oh, wow, jealous. All right. Thanks for joining us, everybody, as always. I'm pretty sure the next Valiant Sunday we're going to be returning to the chronology by looking at the next issue of Harbinger that we need to cover. And I'll let you know what it is. It's issue number 10 of Harbinger is what we'll cover on next Valiant Sunday, unless there's some other big giant news that we need to cover, and then maybe we'll do both. So anyway, as I said, thanks for joining us, as always. Thanks to Jesse for joining. It's always great to have him on to talk Valiant. So hope you enjoyed it, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. The Comic Source is a member of the LRM Podcast Network, so when you visit the site, be sure to check out some of our other podcasts like Los Fanboys, our official movie and TV podcast hosted by Joseph Jammer Medina, Netflix and Chill, hosted by Nick and Carrie, covering a wide variety of film and television topics with Game of Thrones and Star Wars as particular favorites, and finally, Mike and Mark's Marvelous Adventures, as these two former athletes share their love of sports and geek culture by chatting about anything and everything sports and geek related. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.